I think I would like to begin. As you can hear, I'm losing my voice, so I hope you can hear me, and I hope my voice lasts for this presentation. So my name is Lydia White. I'm the Associate Provost for Policies, Procedures, and Equity, and that includes policies relating to promotion to full professor, which is what this session is about. I'm also a professor in the Department of Linguistics. So I'll go through some of the more general procedures and so on, and then there'll be opportunity for questions. But first of all, I'd like to introduce Bonnie Borenstein from the Secretariat. So if you go through the promotion process, the final stage, which involves the university-level committee, the statutory selection committee, it is Bonnie who deals with the process at that level. So what I'm talking about today can be found in Section 8 of the regulations relating the employment of tenure track and tenured academic staff. And also, if any of you are librarians, there's an equivalent section in the librarian regulations. The guidelines, by the way, we'll post the slides, so you don't need to write all this down. But the Secretariat also has guidelines for the dossier at the final stage, which you may or may not choose to follow for earlier steps in the process. So one thing to make clear is there is no specific timing. So unlike reappointment and tenure, which have certain years in which you have to be considered, this is not so for promotion. So your chair or director can recommend you for consideration for promotion at any time. And if you've been an associate professor for at least 5 years, you can request that your department consider you. And in certain exceptional cases, if you've been an associate professor for at least 10 years, you can, in fact, make a special type of request, which I will talk about later on. I know there are, I've heard of chairs who think they shouldn't be putting forward people for promotion before 5 years. That's not so. You can be promoted at any time. It depends on what your dossier looks like and not how many years you have been tenured. So the criteria for promotion are similar to the criteria for tenure, but with different weighting. So the most important criterion is your research and other scholarly activities and related professional activities. Teaching is also taken into consideration, as are other contributions, typically known as service. So what you need to show is a record of excellence in your research, and this will be the kind of evidence you need to produce is international recognition. You also need to show a record of high-quality teaching, excuse me, and a substantial record of other contributions. So this is not meant to be an exhaustive list, but just some examples of ways in which you can demonstrate how your contribution is being recognized internationally. So publications, obviously, research grants, awards, honors, and so on. If you are an editor or on the board of an international journal, book series, whatever, this is important. If you've been involved in organizing international conferences, if you've been an invited speaker at international conferences, if you are involved in your professional organization, for example, you're on the executive committee, if you're on a field where H index or equivalent is considered important, those are the kinds of things that you need to be thinking about presenting as part of your evidence for significant research contribution. So it is your responsibility to prepare your case and pursue your case for promotion. But if you are a chair or a director, or in any case, it is the responsibility of your of chairs and directors to provide guidance to faculty members on whether promotion is something to go for at the present time. We ask chairs to be proactive in this respect. And there are a couple of situations I want to draw to your attention. So if you are a chair or a dean who is not yet a full professor, how should you set about handling this kind of situation? Probably chairs should talk to their deans. Deans should talk to the provost. If your dean and the provost are being proactive, they will have been talking to you. There are some peculiar situations facing certain departments where, let's say, the department has a committee that by department rules must consist only of full professors, and yet the chair of the department is not a full professor. And you know, those kind of situations do arise and can be discussed with me, for example. The other thing I'd like to draw to your attention is we have realized over several years that sometimes female candidates are somewhat reluctant to put themselves forward. So first of all, if you are a female candidate, don't be reluctant. But if you are a chair or a director, do consider that your female candidates may perhaps need more encouragement than male candidates. Sometimes, I think I'll say this at this point, sometimes people ask me, why should I bother? The fact that you're all here suggests that you're interested in bothering. There are a lot of reasons to put yourselves forward or to agree to go forward if you are approached. There's a prestige issue. Being a full professor is recognized inside and outside the university as being of higher stature than being an associate professor. There is a salary increase. Okay, it's not fantastic, but over the years, having 5,000 added to your base salary, it does accumulate. And some people tell me they're afraid to do this because they think they will be asked to be on more committees than they already are. Actually, I don't think that's the case. There very occasionally are committees where the members have to be full professors. But I don't think associate professors are being... I mean, they're being asked to do just as much as everybody else. So I don't actually think that an extra workload because of promotion should prevent anyone or should cause concern, because I don't think it is, in fact, the case. So if you're being considered for promotion, you do need to put together a dossier. We are trying to send out the message this is not meant to be a big deal. It is not meant to be like a tenure dossier. This is actually another thing that people have said. They don't want to go forward for promotion because the thought of putting the dossier together is it would take too much time and so on. But what we do need from you as candidates is a personal statement covering your contributions in the various academic duties, your CV, which should include a list of publications, and anything else you might wish to submit. Now, one thing that I think people did find in the past very time-consuming was the idea that you have to produce a teaching portfolio. That's really not the case. We are not asking for the kind of teaching portfolio that we ask for candidates for tenure. Nevertheless, you might want to look at the guidelines on teaching portfolios just to get a sense of how much and what kind of material to include in your teaching statement. As I said, we're not expecting as much as for tenure. And even for tenure, we're trying to cut down on what people are expected to supply. In addition to your statement, CV, and so on, there are a number of appendices that you should include. And you should include a selection of your publications, preferably in PDF form. Now, it turns out that departments and faculties vary quite a bit as to whether they require copies of publications, and if so, how many. But the external evaluators, and I'll get to them in a moment, they do usually want to see copies of your publications. The statutory selection committee, that's the top level, does not look at publications. It looks at your record, but not at the actual publications. And again, there may be other things that you want to include that are not covered by what I've mentioned so far. So that's what I just said is what you're contributing to your dossier. And then things get added. So at least 4 external evaluator reports will be added. These will have been solicited by the dean. The chair of the department will submit a recommendation from the departmental promotion committee, which may be the same as the departmental tenure committee, or it may be different. And then the dean, or in some cases, there's a faculty advisory committee on promotion. One or other of the chair of that committee or the dean will also submit a written recommendation. So just to talk a bit more about some of these points, external evaluators. So you and your chair establish a list of 8 people who can serve as externals for you. So they must be people who can provide an evaluation of your scholarship. They must be of recognized standing in their field. And typically, we expect them to be full professors or equivalent. And they must not be in a conflict of interest with you. So they mustn't be recent collaborators, for example. And recent is defined at McGill as closer than 5 years, 5 to 6 years. What happens to the list when you've drawn it up, it's submitted to the dean, and it's the dean who contacts people on the list. This results in what is perhaps somewhat anomalous, which is that when the department meets, they don't actually see these letters. It's only the faculty and the statutory selection committee that sees them, with the exception of one faculty, science, where the dean has made sure that the letters go back to the department. So the committees that will be considering you, the 3 levels, your departmental committee. The membership is determined by the department. So as I have already mentioned, there are some departments which only allow full professors to serve on this committee, other departments that allow associate and full. The departmental committee is typically chaired by the chair of the department. Then at the faculty level, in some faculties, only the dean looks at the promotion dossiers, and other faculties, there's a committee that looks at it. So you need to find out from, in your faculty, is it one person or is it a group that's going to be considering your dossier? And the final level is the statutory selection committee, which is advisory to the principal. So notice the following situation. The people who are most likely to know your field or at least be reasonably close to it are members of your department, that committee. At the faculty level, there may also be people who have some understanding of your field. But at the statutory selection committee, it's likely that nobody will know anything about your field. So it's, you know, how does your dossier seem to an outsider at that point? If you're in a joint appointment, then the promotion committee, it should be one committee with representation from both departments, not two separate committees. So if we go to this top-level committee, the statutory selection committee, it's chaired by the provost, and it includes the following: two members of the Board of Governors, the vice principal research and international relations, or her delegate. I sometimes serve, for example, as her delegate on this committee. The dean of your faculty, two members selected by Senate. There are sort of Senate has lists of people who can serve this function. And then, interestingly, the chair of the department isn't, the statutes don't say that the chair should be on this committee, but typically the chair is, because there's a certain leeway for the principal to add people. And normally the only person who gets added is the chair. And then Bonnie Bornstein, or one of her colleagues in the secretariat, will serve as secretary to this committee. So just to go into a bit more detail, the department committee will consider the dossier whenever you decide that you're ready to submit it. As I said, there's no particular timeline. I have to make one caveat there. I believe in the Faculty of Medicine, the faculty draws up certain deadlines for when the faculty committee is going to meet. I believe it's the only faculty that does that. But departments do not have particular deadlines for this. So if your department is in favor of your promotion, they will make a recommendation to the dean, a written recommendation giving reasons. If the department decides not to recommend you, they will tell you in writing, giving reasons, and the information will not be passed up, right? So it's just at the local level, you know, and your department knows, and quite often it's the department thinks you should wait a year or two and try again. So the rationale for not reporting up is when you do try again, it should be, so to speak, clean higher up. That's the idea. Some people would prefer that it be reported up, but so far that is not happening. So the level of the dean, which may be a faculty committee, when the dean receives a positive recommendation, then the external letters are solicited. So this is why I said the department is usually making its decision without the external letters, though I know of some departments that do sort of consult externally with people who are not on the official list. And we usually allow this in the case of promotion. It's absolutely prohibited in the case of tenure. So if the dean or the dean's committee is in favor of promotion, they then make a recommendation, a written recommendation. And again, if the dean is not inclined to recommend, you are told in writing with reasons, and it's again not reported higher than the faculty level. So, assuming a positive recommendation, the statutory selection committee is established. That is set up by the secretariat. And then the candidate has to deposit the dossier with the secretary general. And if it hasn't been in electronic form up to now, it must be from this point on, with certain exceptions. For example, if you have books that you don't have in e-versions, they can be received. You can, at any point in the process, add stuff, right? So if you want to say something more, add more material, you can do so at any stage, including this stage. So the Statutory Selection Committee meets to consider your case. I've already mentioned who's on that committee. What happens is your dean makes a presentation in your favor, and then the chair usually adds supporting remarks. So if the Statutory Selection Committee makes a positive recommendation, which they usually do, but not quite inevitably, the committee actually gives the dean or the chair permission to tell the candidate right away, but you aren't promoted until the Board of Governors has officially approved. So the promotion will take effect the first day of the month after the board has seen the list of candidates for promotion. Again, if there's a negative recommendation, you would get written reasons. As I've said, that what I've been talking about is the normal route. That is to say, and this is true however long you've been an associate professor, you know, 2 years or 20, that what I've just described is the normal route. However, there are cases where candidates feel that their department will, let's say, will not give them a fair assessment, or their department consists perhaps entirely of people who are non-experts in their field or whatever. If you've got a good reason to believe that, first of all, you have to have been associate professor for at least 10 years. If you've got a good reason to believe that the normal route is not going to give you an appropriate hearing, you can apply. This is very misleading. I've put there, you can apply once for direct consideration by the Statutory Selection Committee. It's by no means direct. In fact, it involves most of the steps that I've just described. It's just that the Statutory Selection Committee knows to take them with a pinch of salt, let's say. So if you go this unusual route, the department still has to be asked whether they would like to make a comment on you or assess you. And in some cases, the department say no, and others they say yes. So the candidate makes a request to the principal and deposits the principal, who delegates it to the provost, who delegates it to me. So the dossier is not going to the department in this case. It's going to whoever is dealing with it higher up. And it's not the department chair and the candidate who draw up the list. So the provost or the provost delegate and the candidate draw up the list of eight names. And instead of the dean soliciting the letters, the provost or delegate solicit the letters. By the way, I don't know if I said this before. It applies both in this circumstance and the more usual one. It's very important to have non-Canadians on your list of potential evaluators. The Statutory Selection Committee really doesn't like it if all the letters are from Canadian universities. So as I said, the departmental committee is invited to make an assessment or a recommendation, and so is the dean, and then there's a meeting of the Statutory Selection Committee. And because these situations are somewhat unusual, often the deliberations of the Statutory Selection Committee will be in greater depth than the deliberations in the normal case, where two committees have already looked in depth at the situation. If any of you feel you're in this situation, please talk to me before initiating anything so that we can discuss the suitability. So just to wind up, and then we'll open it up for questions. Very important to talk to your chairs and directors about the possibility of promotion. Is this the right time? When should you go up? And so on. And if you are chairs or directors, mentor your associate professors. Think about women who may be holding back. Of course, not all women hold back, but some do. Ensure that your requirements as a department or as a faculty are actually consistent with university requirements. We have found some cases where departments and or faculties seem to be, let's say, extremely strict in what they're expecting, perhaps somewhat more so than the university is expecting. I'm there to help you interpret the regulations. My email is there. And if you need help with the procedural issues, especially the final steps, you can contact Bonnie Borenstein in the Secretariat. Bonnie, do you want to add anything before I open this up for questions? And if so, use a mic. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything really to add other than what you mentioned, that the documents must be electronic. And if we have any questions, we usually speak to the faculty, which is the last level before the Secretariat.
Okay, so questions? Yes, Bernard.
When it comes to criteria, what would be the role of supervision, and specifically graduate supervision?
So this is a question that also faces tenure candidates. Is graduate supervision teaching or is it research? We usually encourage people to put it, it's certainly important. In fact, it's very important. Now, think about it. Statutory selection committees sometimes comment if a candidate doesn't seem to have done much graduate student supervision. So they do like to see that. On the other hand, there are cases where people are either not in units with graduate programs or not in a position to supervise for whatever reason. And that's the kind of thing, if you feel yourself there's a gap in your dossier, that's partly what the teaching statement is for, not only to say what you have done, what you've achieved, etc., but it's also a point where you could say, I haven't had the opportunity to supervise many PhD students, but I've had a lot of master's students, I've had a lot of honors students. You sort of put in the positive aspects of what might seem to be a gap in your profile. But I would definitely, so first of all, definitely include a supervision, and I would say include it as teaching. Yes, at the back.
You said that research was more important than the other two, service, and is there a approximate weighting?
No. I'll tell you how the current, and who is outgoing, provost does it. That is to say, when he's chairing this SSC, he says, let's first establish that the person has indeed achieved an international reputation of sufficient caliber, and then we look at teaching and service. So the point is, having a stellar international reputation is not enough. You have got to show really strong performance in all three. But having a stellar teaching performance and nothing spectacular in terms of research is also not enough. So I can't give a weighting except to say that the research component is always considered first.
And then a follow-up question. What is approximate percentage of people who apply receive full professor?
Okay, so this one's hard to answer because, as I mentioned, we don't know about the refusals lower down, right? So we know that it happens that the department will say, we think you need to wait, or get one more book if you're in that kind of discipline or whatever. but we don't know how many. We at the faculty level, we also don't know, because there are people who get through the department committee with a positive recommendation, and then the faculty says no, or it says, you know, wait a year or two. So it's only at the top level that there are any statistics. Bonnie, do you know approximately how many people per year?
Oh, it really fluctuates.
Can you put the mic on? Yeah.
It fluctuates, and it's been increasing over time. So there's been a heavy encouragement by the current provost to move promotion dossiers through the university and to have more professors have promotion quickly. So, for example, in Faculty of Medicine, the last 3 years, we've had at least 21 per year, times three. Other faculties would be a bit less, but it's getting heavier. These dossiers are, the volume is getting heavier. But as to add to your other question, we shouldn't really think of it as a failure when a department is not ready to move a dossier forward, because sometimes it's just a matter of a year or two, and they'll inform the candidate of that. They'll have a discussion with the candidate and say, well, we think you should have one more year of a certain type of experience, and then we will move the promotion dossier. So I don't think it's like pass-fail in any way. It's more about timing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So in terms of how many people does the statutory selection committee reject, it's extremely unusual. It's probably, you know, less than five in the last 10 years, I would think. I mean, since you've been in the secretariat, have there been any?
I haven't seen any.
It's really unusual for a statutory selection committee to turn down someone who has been assessed in considerable detail by their department and their faculty. So, in fact, even saying it, 5 in 10 years, then that's too high. It's probably one or two. Yeah. Yes.
Yes, you mentioned that the dossier is not meant to be a big deal. So I suspect it's not a repetition of the CV itself, an extended repetition. But could you give us the feeling of a typical length of this dossier?
Sorry, I'm not quite understanding the question.
The dossier itself, you said it's not a big deal, right? So I suppose it's not as extended as we would think, probably. So, but what's a typical length of a dossier?
Typical length is impossible to say. The ones from the Faculty of Medicine are too long. you know, your statement should be as long as it needs to be for you to convey to various committees what you've been doing, what you have achieved. Your CV is as long as it's going to be. And your, you know, extra documents like publications, however many you feel the need for. But let me give you some examples of things that people sometimes put in and that we don't want to see. So, for example, some people include letters, supposing they've got a research grant. They'll include the letter from the funding council saying, congratulations, you were awarded such and such for this period. We trust you, if you put on your CV that you got a grant from this year to that year, we'll believe you. We do not want to see the letter. So there are all sorts of things like that that do not need to be included. The documentation that you should include is stuff that might illustrate a point or enhance a point that isn't obvious from your statement and your CV, but not bureaucratic letters saying you got this, that, and the other. Not letters inviting you to give talks at conferences or plenaries or whatever. That'll be on your CV, and that's enough. So that's what I mean when I say it shouldn't be too onerous, because we don't want that kind of stuff. Yes.
I have three things that I wanted to ask. One is, can the dean ask all eight of your externals for letters, and will he only look at four, or if you can get eight, they'll look at eight?
Good question. The dean does ask all eight and looks at however many come in. So typically, eight do not come in. And sometimes, unfortunately, four don't come in. And so if, but four or five is fairly typical, sometimes six. If the dean can't get four, he or she may get back to you to say, could you add to the list? Because we haven't got enough people who've agreed to do it. And if people don't agree to do it, it's a curious thing. The board members on the statutory selection committee tend to think this is a bad sign, whereas the academic members know this is just they were too busy, right? So don't feel that it's anything negative if somebody comes back and says, I need a few more names. It'll just be that people have said, you know, I'm on sabbatical, I'm too busy, or whatever.
Can you contact these externals to say that you might be...
No, please don't do that. Okay. No.
Can you include a letter, let's say, from your postdoctoral mentor that has followed your career for many years, but you feel, or from anyone that you feel would have a conflict of interest to be on the list, but could actually give a lot of value in terms of their knowledge of your career?
Yes, that one's more complicated. Bonnie, do you want to answer that?
Well, we just had a recent dossier where somebody included a letter from a person of that nature, but he did it at the end of the dossier, so it wasn't an inclusion as one of the evaluation letters?
Yeah, that's what I meant. Like, I could just ask like my postdoc mentor who's known my career for the whole time and just say, would you want to just, you know, summarize what you feel? And it's too close. I would never ask him to be an external because it's too close, but he, you know, he knows about me wanting to do this and has said, I can write you a great letter because I know your career for your whole life. So it's like...
What do you...
I would say it does no harm.
Okay.
The committees can choose to ignore it.
Sure.
Right.
Okay.
So,
I was surprised that you said to put in a selection of publications because, everything's on PubMed, so...
This may vary from discipline to discipline as to whether your publications are available, easily available to the externals.
Okay, so if they're all there in PubMed...
If they're all there and you know... No. If you're in a discipline where your publications are somewhere that everyone has access... that you don't need to.
Okay, and the final thing is, can you say a little bit more about the teaching dossier? Because I know for tenure, it was a large part of the tenure dossier, and I'm struggling with really what I need to have in there to reflect the teaching. Do you need to put in the appendix all these evaluations? And if you do, do you need it from every year?
Okay.
It's a big...
We've actually cut down on those requirements even for tenure now because it was too much. What I suggest you do is do look at the guidelines for the dossiers. You'll see that they're much reduced. We do want to see list of your graduate students, including when they were your student and maybe what their thesis topic was, mm-hmm. and a table perhaps showing what courses you've taught. How far are you, not just the last couple of years, I mean, go back a few years, and maybe on the table include the teaching evaluation scores for what are considered to be the four essential questions on the teaching evaluations. They're the first four questions that the students have to answer. It's about this is a good course, this is a good instructor, those kind of things, but not everything else. And do not bother to include, all the detailed teaching evaluations. I think people want to see... but they do want to see evidence, that you have been teaching, that you've been teaching well, that your teaching is appreciated. So, high teaching evaluation scores is helpful. And sort of other things that might, relate to your teaching. Yeah, but not lots and lots of teaching evaluations.
And in the tenure dossier, you tended to look at your evaluation scores and had to say how you sort of rank with other teachers in this.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really need to do that for promotion. If your teaching scores are low, however, you should consider whether you should be going forward for promotion. But if they're, if they're high, then just give those scores. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, back.
Just a comment about the teaching evaluations and then a question. Since we've gone to the online course evaluations, the numbers of students who reply are very low. Oftentimes, the students who do it are the students who have an axe to grind. And so they're really a poor way to evaluate teaching. And if you're teaching a class that has a small number of students, and there's one disgruntled student in there, it can really compromise the scores. So how are we to address that issue since we can no longer, I mean, we used to go into classrooms and everybody filled them out, right? So there was a more balanced perspective. So what do we do in these kinds of situations? How are those evaluations really considered?
This is a very good point. And teaching TLS, Teaching and Learning Services, insists that although the response rate is lower, it's not the case that you're just getting disgruntled students. And, you know, I do not know whether that is the case or not. I think, you know, one way of dealing with it is to point out the kinds of things that you've just pointed out. And the other thing is, I think many of you will be in a situation where students will email you or write to you and say, what a great course, you know, I really enjoyed it. And you can include that kind of material to either balance or enhance the teaching evaluation scores. I also suggest that you actually talk to TLS about this problem. They do have they have guidelines about how to interpret teaching evaluations. And I think probably at the department and faculty level, people are kind of aware of this, but the Statutory Selection Committee, they certainly are not. But one part of the guidelines that they include class, if your class size is less than a certain number, you should not take any notice of the teaching evaluations if you've had fewer than X percent of the class. So if you've got evaluations from what you said, a small class with one disgruntled student, and only one or two students replied, you shouldn't be using those evaluations at all. It's not a reasonable assessment of your performance. So TLS can give you more information about that kind of thing and how to use the evaluations. And I suppose it's possible that in some cases you may have to do the interpretation in your dossier because some of the committee members will not know about these problems.
Then my second question was, with regard to external funding, if the kinds of work you're doing doesn't lend itself to large grants and that kind of thing, or some of the work you're doing doesn't even require funding, how is external funding considered in the evaluation of the dossier?
It is considered on a discipline-by-discipline basis. That is to say, people in the social sciences and humanities are not going to be expected to bring in the dollars that people in natural and medical sciences might bring in. So, the committees are aware that there are dramatic differences in levels of funding and, indeed, as you said, need for funding across disciplines. But again, I think this is something you should say in your statement. Just point it out. Yes.
I have two questions. In our dossier, should we focus on our career since receiving tenure, since at McGill, or our whole career?
I would focus on the whole career. If you've come, if McGill was not your starting point, what you did before is nevertheless part of, you know, we are looking now at people not just post-tenure, and not just at McGill, but overall, are you of a stature that deserves promotion? So put in as much as you want, go back as far as you want. Okay. Yeah.
And what happens if a new chair, dean, and or provost gets appointed during the process? Do they typically honor the decisions of their predecessors in terms of encouragement to apply and choice of external reviewers, et cetera?
That's a good question. And it may face, several of you may be faced with this right now because we've got a dramatic turnover of deans and a new provost coming in. And the answer is I don't know, but I assume that the recommendations of a previous incumbent are respected. Do you have any?
With regards to the provost, the candidates that are about to be scheduled for the SSE, whatever we have in our lap will be completed before the provost leaves. So at the SSE level, there will be full completion. So it's just from the faculty moving downwards that there might be candidates somewhere in the process.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I know someone who is discouraged by the chair to put forward application for the promotion on the basis of two reasons. The first reason, I think you clarified today, so it's not the case. So the fact that that person hasn't completed fifth year after the 10-year promotion. So in the beginning of your presentation, you said there's no minimum or maximum requirement. So that's okay. Second reason was that previous year, several associate professors lodged the application for promotion. And then, according to the chair, it is highly unlikely to have, say, multiple promotions from one department.
Is that really true? No. There is no quota, right? Promotion is for those who have, in quotes, earned it by their work, their reputation, et cetera, et cetera. And there is no quota for departments, and there is also no time. I mean, you can be considered for promotion earlier than 5 years. But it's true that I've heard this idea that there's a quota before, so some chairs do seem to think that. And I've certainly heard from some chairs, before 5 years is just too soon. So in such cases, if your chair is hesitant for those kinds of reasons, I would suggest that the candidate be asked to, you talk to me, and we can discuss whether the chair needs a little bit of educating in this regard, because it's clear that. That many chairs don't know they haven't got all the regulations at their fingertips. Any other? Excuse me. Well, if there are no more questions, we'll end the session now. And I was going to say, I look forward to seeing your dossiers in due course. But as this is my last year as associate provost, it'll be somebody else.
Unless it's your department.
Unless it's my department, yes.